Welcome to Fallen Heroes, a novel written by Barry Nugent and narrated by David Ault. Chapter 8. I wait. I watch. I listen. They tell me I must be swift, deadly, and act without mercy. So I strike like the fiercest of storms, and then back to the abyss, back to a world of nightmares and oblivion. I know I once walked upon this earth, but my memories are hidden from me, shrouded in darkness. Who I am, how I came to be, are all mysteries to me. If they knew of my ritual, I would be punished. I do not seek their anger, for without them I am nothing, just another monstrosity. I cannot help myself. After my work is complete, I do not fade. I watch and wait. After all, what good is the game, if I cannot see my opponents? It is not long before the police arrive. Then those who seek to learn more of my work so that they may tell others of its greatness. I watch them fight and argue. I move freely among them. They peer through the gates, squabbling like they're young. It is now, as always, I feel a need, the urge to cleanse myself of the filth surrounding me. Humans. Even to whisper the name causes my tongue to blister. It has been hundreds of years since I was one, that much I do remember. But now the thought of my former human existence sickens me. I see their wide eyes and their warm bodies, and I cry out in disgust, but they do not hear me. How easily I could rip the spine from the overweight bald man attempting to bribe the policeman guarding the gates. The joy I would feel as my hands pierced the lungs of the red-faced photographer, who stands inches from my outstretched hand. As I move past him, he is no longer red-faced. His face is pale, and he feels cold. He draws his coat tighter. It is not the cold or the rain. It is the fear you feel. Stark, unforgiving fear. It is me you feel. There is nothing of worth for me here. Once more, I leap over the fence and run towards the house. The rain feels good, though I have no real substance save when I strike. It gives me comfort to imagine it pouring down my face and into my open mouth. Although nothing in this world can harm me, it is sometimes good to taste nature's fury. I crouch some distance from the house and watch the two humans standing by the entrance to the house. I move closer and see a man and a woman moving up the stairs. Their fear flies to me like a dying lover seeking a last embrace. The woman senses me, her fierce gaze bores into me. I've seen enough. I will not strike now. I will return and tell those whom I serve what I have seen. I concentrate and shield myself further. Finally, they doubt their eyes and continue up the stairs. If only they understood. There is more to the world than what can be seen and heard. There is me.
Relax, Kelly, suggested Clancy. Kelly walked over to the drinks cabinet, which lined the wall of the large hotel suite. He snatched a half-full bottle of gin from one of the shelves.
It's easy for you to say, Chief, said Kelly.
He filled his glass with gin, downed the contents, and poured himself another.
Hey, go easy on that stuff, said a tall, dark-skinned man who, like Clancy and the others in the room, was wearing dark blue overalls with the words Repair Service emblazoned on the back.
Back off, Hammond, warned Kelly, fixing an angry stare at the man.
Hammond appeared unfazed by the threat. He continued sharpening the combat knife he held with the aid of a small whetstone. Kelly pointed his empty glass at Hammond like an accusing finger.
Hey! I'm talking to you!
Hammond drew back some of his shoulder-length dreadlocks, revealing an ugly scar running from the tip of his left eyebrow down to his mouth. He laughed, and then went back to his knife sharpening. The other men in the room, who had been engaged in their own preparations, turned to watch the drama unfold.
Come on, Kelly, knock it off, mate,
put in a slim, tough-looking blonde-haired man shouldering an M16. He was stood by one of the windows. His Cockney accent, along with Kelly's Irish and Hammond's deep southern drawl, gave the group a definite international flavour.
Stay out of this, Stoney, said Kelly, without bothering to look in the Englishman's direction, unless you want a piece of me.
I wouldn't know what to do with it, Stony replied, before returning to his window vigil.
Anyone else here have a problem with my drinking? Said Kelly, spreading his arms out to either side.
No one answered.
Kelly walked over to Hammond, who was sitting on a wooden chair that had been reversed, allowing him to rest his large forearms on the chair's back.
Seems like it's just you with a problem.
This time Hammond stopped what he was doing and looked up at Kelly. Clancy could not read anything from the big man's posture, which was never a good sign.
Damn it. Like he didn't have enough things to worry about.
Looks to me, said Hammond, staring at the bottle Kelly was holding, that the only one here with a problem is you.
Kelly dropped the bottle and his right hand instinctively flew to his holster. A second later, the tip of his gun was inches from the bridge of Hammond's nose.
How about now? Kelly sneered.
You still got a problem?
No, said Hammond, his eyes narrowing. Now we both have one.
Clancy glanced downwards to see the tip of Hammond's combat knife resting against Kelly's groin.
You so much as breathe, little man, and you'll be singing soprano, you hear?
And you'll be missing a forehead.
They held their positions, each one appearing to wait for the other to make the first move.
Clancy strode across the room to the two men. Removing his own gun from its holster, Clancy folded his arms, ensuring the gun was clearly visible. He looked at both men before speaking.
You have 3 seconds to start acting like professionals before things get messy in here. It's your call.
It did not even come to Clancy beginning his countdown before the two men lowered their weapons. Satisfied that the situation was resolved, Clancy holstered his gun and snatched the glass out of Kelly's hands, pouring the remaining contents out onto the floor.
No more booze.
Kelly nodded begrudgingly. Clancy placed the glass back in the cabinet.
Where had it all gone so wrong?
At the beginning, their objectives were clear. Payback. Pure and simple retribution. Now everything was different because they were different.
They had served their country, even if some of them were not native to its soil, obeyed their superiors, and always remained loyal.
In the name of freedom and to protect the United States from her enemies, they had committed atrocities that had damned them forever and tainted them all. Every time Clancy's morals caused him to question an order, the only reply he received from those in command was, "The price of freedom is often high." Clancy was amazed how easily he had been convinced back then. It was nothing more than crap to feed the foot soldiers, the cannon fodder. The suits in Washington did not give a damn about who lived and who died. They never lost a night's sleep worrying about the innocent deaths they had ordered. No, to them they were statistics, flags on a map, representing places they would never visit. Clancy and his men bought into the bullshit, the fake flag waving, and off they marched to another bloodbath, another massacre. After years of faithful service and unquestioned loyalty, Clancy and his men discovered the most brutal rule in war. Everyone is expendable. In a single, dispassionate moment, their lives were deemed acceptable losses by those whose only concept of warfare was computer-assisted strategies. On a mission to assassinate an arms dealer, they arrived to find that said arms dealer had, only hours earlier, secured a deal with the CIA to pass on valuable information on terrorist activity in that area. With the government taking on the role of Judas, Clancy and his team were sold out. Details of the mission were passed to the arms dealer, and an armed security force was on hand to ensure Clancy and his team were given a fitting reception. It was only thanks to Clancy's leadership that he and his team were able to escape their captors and flee into the jungle. After a bloody game of hide-and-seek which lasted 14 days and claimed the lives of more than half of Clancy's team, the survivors made it back to the States. They were alive, but now men without a cause. Like the Ronin warriors of legend who wandered the earth masterless, Clancy and his team embraced a new career. They sold themselves on the mercenary marketplace. Friends, allies, all were now potential targets. No one was spared. As the years passed, Clancy saw the atrocities they had committed begin to take its toll. Kelly, who had been with him since the beginning, was the most affected. The nightmares, excessive drinking, and bouts of unnecessary anger like the one Clancy had just witnessed were all symptoms. Another year at the most, and Kelly would become a dangerous liability to the team. When the time came, Clancy promised himself he would take care of the situation, permanently. Secretly, he hoped Kelly would stop a bullet before he'd have to face that time.
"Wheels is here," said Stoney.
Two blasts sounded from a car horn outside.
"Time to move, people," said Clancy.
He grabbed his automatic rifle and placed it inside a large duffel bag. No words passed between the others as they checked their weapons before concealing them and heading out of the room in single file. Clancy led them out of the hotel and round to a secluded side street where a grey van was waiting for them. Clancy poked his head through the van's side window where the youngest member of their unit, Boris, or Wheels as he liked to be called, was waiting. Always eager to please, Wheels possessed driving skills rivaling any rally driver. His bleached white hair, which gave him his distinctive albino look, was safely tucked away under a navy blue baseball cap. However, the silver nose stud and earrings were not so easy to miss.
"No, sir," said Wheels, traces of a German accent showing through his forced American. "Everything was, as Stoney would say, a piece of peace."
"Good. Get ready to move out." Wheels nodded. Clancy walked round to the back of the van. The men were seated inside, checking their weapons and equipment whilst going over their assigned duties. "Gentlemen, I want no unnecessary civilian casualties, but our employers must have that disc back, or we don't get paid. Are we clear?"
"Yes, sir,"
the men answered back in unison.
"Our target is a dangerous man. He makes a move you don't like. Take him down." "Yes, sir."
Clancy said nothing more. He slammed the van doors shut and made his way round to the passenger side of the van. Wheels was already starting the engine when Clancy climbed in.
"Let's move."
The van pulled out and set off down the street. Clancy noted the speedometer creeping up and reminded Wheels to keep to the speed limit. They could do without attracting any unnecessary attention before they reached their destination. Clancy hoped the hand had enjoyed his stay of execution in Japan, because he was about to discover it was a short-lived reprieve.
4 years of peaceful and uneventful academia.
4 years of swearing never to return to Torch. Catherine would not play the game anymore. She envied those who would never see what she saw, save in their nightmares, shielded from the horrors they found there by the simple act of waking up. Catherine's nightmares were inspired by the real terrors of her former work. Murder, rape, mutilation. They were not just headlines in the morning paper. Each headline brought with it past images that were burned into her subconscious. The faces of those she could not save. Catherine saw them all, felt their pain, their frustration. Why? Why them? Each time the answer was different, a different craving that could only be satisfied with blood. But in spite of the horror and bloodshed, she was still drawn to darkness, to the need to know why. 4 years ago, she had left Torch in an attempt to preserve what little of her sanity still remained. She turned to writing and researching the criminal mind in the hope of turning her talent to a different, less dangerous use.
"Here we are," said Luther, wrapping his hand around the door handle.
"Wait. Let me." Luther stepped aside. Catherine moved to the door and pushed it open. The bedroom was shrouded in darkness, save for the occasional flash of red and blue from the police sirens outside, and the beam from Luther's flashlight. Catherine entered, switching on her own torch as she did so. Blood was everywhere. The lavish cashmere carpet, the blue satin sheets, all had been transformed into a crimson mosaic of blood and gore. Catherine tried to stem the imagery that was flooding her mind, the torment inflicted upon the sleeping couple. It was hopeless. The savage but beautifully efficient brutality almost overwhelmed her. Time to concentrate. There would be time enough later to deal with the effects of what she had seen tonight.
"They did not go quietly."
"I take it you're referring to those." Luther was pointing at several shell casings strewn about the bedroom floor. The forensic team had already been through the bedroom and noted the positions of the shell casings. They had left them unmoved. Luther crouched down, picked up one of the casings and turned it over in his hand.
This is special ordnance. Armor-piercing. What's a lawyer need such serious firepower for? Asked Catherine.
Whatever he needed it for, it wasn't enough. Catherine stared at the bed. It was here that the bodies were discovered, lying spread-eagled on the bed. According to those first on the scene, the Carsons had been ripped open from just below the navel up to the throat. An even more disturbing aspect of the crime was the apparent removal of Carson's internal organs, though she would have to wait for the autopsy to confirm this. Walking round the king-sized bed, Catherine's eyes never left the spot where the bodies had lain. She stopped when she reached the other side. Once there, she continued to stare for a few more seconds, then she looked over at the door and then down to where she was standing. Finally, she lifted her head and locked her eyes with Luther's patient yet questioning gaze.
He was paying them homage, she said quietly. He respected them.
Carson was butchered like cattle. I wouldn't call that respectful, would you? The look on Luther's face told Catherine her colleague was still unconvinced. She went over to him.
Look at the facts, Luther.
What facts? The guards outside were virtually torn apart, battered beyond recognition, right?
So?
Catherine knew it was Luther's nature never to accept anything at face value. It was a good trait, but it was also an annoying one.
He kills two well-trained soldiers in seconds. He's angry. It was too easy. There was no challenge. He goes mad and tears apart what was left of them.
Catherine gestured to the bed.
And here, in the last place he expects, he finds a challenge and he pays them respect for giving him that gift. Yes, the bodies were mutilated, but their faces were unmarked, their eyes left open to see their enemy.
Luther rubbed his chin. I suppose that sort of hangs together.
That must have hurt, thought Catherine,
but she refrained from voicing her opinions.
Look at the spread of the ammo casings, said Luther, changing the subject. Looks to me like our lawyer friend was firing blind.
I know, said Catherine. She began opening the drawers of the dressing table behind her.
It's almost as if...
What? Catherine knew Luther was not going to like her reply one bit, but then that was pretty much par for the course between the two of them, even after all these years.
As if he knew something was in the room, but somehow couldn't see it.
Right, scoffed Luther, his voice laced with sarcasm. You want me to walk into Chardon's office and tell him we're looking for an invisible serial killer?
If it was not for the victims already in her head demanding someone grant them justice, Catherine would have left there and then.
She glared at Luther for a second or two, then calmed herself down before speaking. There was no use flying off the handle at him. Luther had been one of the more tolerant agents she had worked with when it came to her leaps of intuition, as she liked to think of them.
There are a lot of things I'm not even close to understanding about the killer yet.
As Catherine spoke, she lifted a large black organizer from the bottom of the middle drawer of the bedside table.
But I'm convinced these murders are ritualistic and have been influenced by the occult.
And the second thing?
It took a moment for Catherine to reply to Luther's question. She was far more concerned with a particular page within the organizer she was holding. Whatever our friend may be, he's no serial killer.
How can I be so sure? Said Catherine, finishing her friend's sentence.
Our friend would be better described as an assassin as opposed to a serial killer.
He just enjoys what he does. Catherine saw the utter belief in Luther's eyes, but pressed on regardless.
Those first on the scene stated the other rooms were ransacked as if the killer were looking for something. Why bother if you've just come here to go on a crazed killing spree?
Nothing was reported taken from any of the other rooms, besides the Carson's organs. The killer took no trophies, nothing that would allow him to relive the experience. That doesn't fit a usual profile for the majority of serial killer cases.
But couldn't the Carson's organs be considered trophies?
True, agreed Catherine, not lifting her eyes from the book.
But I think once the police have done a thorough examination of the grounds, they'll find what's left of the organs.
Our friend didn't need them. The act of removing them was enough to honor his victims.
What are you saying?
I'm saying maybe the Carsons weren't the real target, said Catherine, tossing the organizer over to Luther. Take a look at yesterday's page. There, clearly marked in black felt-tip pen under yesterday's date, were the words, Jason home from uni, pick up from station.
You reckon he came to kill this Jason?
I know it's a wild theory.
You're damn right it's wild. Let's just assume this nut is some kind of sick cross between a serial killer and a hitman. Why couldn't the target have been the Carsons?
You dragged me into this mess because you wanted my insight, and I'm telling you this boy is in danger.
Luther and Catherine shared a look for a moment. Catherine knew he was trying to decide just how damaged she still was. At last Luther sighed and took out his mobile. She listened to the brief conversation but was unsure what Luther was trying to find out.
It seems our Mr. Carson and his wife had an adopted son studying in England, he said, after hanging up.
Jason, right?
Jason Chen, said Luther, closing the organizer. It looks like...
Luther became silent. He was just staring into the empty drawer.
What? What is it?
The window! He shouted. Go!
Catherine watched Luther slide across the room at such a speed it appeared as if he were gliding on a sheet of ice. Reaching the bedside table, Luther lifted the table with both hands and hurled it through one of the bedroom windows before setting off towards it, Catherine two steps behind him. Catherine had no idea what was happening, but Luther's flair for spotting danger had saved her life in the past, so she was willing to trust it now. The table crashed headlong through the window and out into the torrential downpour outside. Behind it, both Luther and Catherine dived through the shattered second-floor window. Time froze and caught its breath. A second later, the first floor of the house exploded in a blazing cataclysm of flames and debris. A silence followed, only to be broken by the crackling of the inferno that now raged through the top floors of the house. From his vantage point inside his patrol car, Sergeant Bernice watched the carnage unfold like a silent melodrama. Police cars and officers were already racing up to the house.
"Too late," said Bernice, watching the mad exodus towards the house.
Placing the detonator back in the glove compartment, Bernice flipped open his mobile. He dialed the number he had been given and waited.
"Is it done?" asked a voice.
"Yes."
"Excellent," said the voice. "Of course, I will ensure that no stone is left unturned. I will do everything to ensure this senseless double murder does not go unpunished." If it were not for the money now winging its way to his private account, Bernice might have felt sorry for murdering the two torch agents. He dismissed the emotion as a brief lapse in character. In less than 5 minutes, the laptop beside him would register the transfer was complete, and he would have 100,000 ways with which to appease the remainder of his conscience. That was Chapter 8 of Fallen Heroes. Thanks for listening.